From MainePublic.org, here's the news for This Day in Maine, Monday, October 3rd, 2016. I'm Andrew Catalina, and for Barbara Caridi. And on this day, Donald Trump has canceled the Portland rally originally set for this Thursday. A federal court has denied Dennis DeShane's appeal for a new trial in connection with his murder conviction. And Poland Spring, the iconic bottled water company based in Maine, has been affected by the ongoing drought here. Those stories and more after this.
This Day in Maine is made possible by listeners and Kennebec Valley Community College, offering a late start semester beginning September 26th, kvcc.me.edu.
Republican presidential nominee Donald Trump has canceled his rally in Portland, according to city officials. Steve Missler has more.
City spokeswoman Jessica Grondin said the campaign canceled because of routing issues, which she interpreted as a scheduling conflict. The rally was originally supposed to be held at the Portland Expo on Thursday. Grondin said the campaign hopes to reschedule, but it has yet to identify any dates with the city. Trump is attempting to peel off at least one of Maine's four electoral votes, a split that has never happened in state history. Recent polls suggest he could pull it off because of strong support in Maine's 2nd congressional district. The last Republican presidential candidate to win the entire state was George H.W. Bush in 1988. Trump has been on the defensive for nearly a week, following an uneven debate performance and recent revelation that he claimed a nearly $1 billion loss on his 1995 federal tax return. Such a loss could have allowed him to avoid paying federal income tax for nearly two decades. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Steve Missler.
A federal appeals court has apparently ended the appeals of Dennis DeShane, convicted of the 1988 murder and sexual assault of Sarah Cherry, then a 12-year-old from Bowdoin. Mallory has more.
Since his first trial and through appeal after appeal, Dennis DeShane has maintained his innocence. But a jury convicted him of sexually assaulting Sarah Cherry, stabbing her, and dumping her body in the woods near the Bowdoin home where she was babysitting. The state Supreme Court upheld his conviction. Motions for a new trial were denied. This latest attempt to get a federal court to order a new trial was rejected unanimously by the three-judge First Circuit Court of Appeals. The state attorney general's office in an email says DeShane has no further appeals in the court system, so after nearly three decades, the case may be finally closed. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Mal Leary.
Over the weekend, the Department of Homeland Security urged states to ensure their election systems are secure from hackers. Maine Secretary of State Matt Dunlap says federal officials are overreacting.
They're talking about security breaches when they don't really understand the systems themselves. They sort of assume it's the same type of a data breach that you see with one of the large data brokers.
Dunlap says Maine and many states use a paper-based system that can't be hacked. He says the online part of the system is the centralized voter registration list, and it has state-of-the-art protection. Even if breached, Dunlap says that database has nothing to do with the vote tallying process, which is decentralized and paper-based. U.S. Senator Susan Collins of Maine isn't on the ballot this fall, but that doesn't mean she's sitting at home. She's committed to appear with as many state legislative candidates as she can to bolster their campaigns, with a particular focus on keeping the state Senate in Republican hands. And she's also helping some of her U.S. Senate colleagues.
I believe it's very important at the federal level and at the state level that we maintain control of the Republican Senate.
Collins says she's already campaigned for U.S. Senator Kelly Ayotte of New Hampshire, and that despite her decision not to support Donald Trump as the party's presidential nominee, she's getting a lot of requests to campaign and appear at fundraising events by Republican Senate candidates across the country.
I'm pleased to say that despite the fact that I cannot support Donald Trump to be our next president, that my Republican colleagues still seem very eager for me to come campaign for them.
¶¶ U.S. Representative Bruce Poliquin of Maine's 2nd District has submitted legislation that he says will resolve recent disputes between Mainers who make their living along the shorefront near Acadia National Park. Marine worm diggers, seaweed harvesters, and clammers met recently with Poliquin regarding a park policy that they say prevents them from harvesting marine resources from the intertidal zone around Acadia property. Poliquin says that if the park wants congressional approval to expand its boundaries in its eastern Scutic district with land donated last year, it has to let the local populace make a living.
There is a boundary issue at Acadia National Park that they're working out. And I made it very clear to all the parties involved, I will not sign off on this boundary issue unless we include language that protects our wormers and clammers and those that harvest periwinkles from using the intertidal flats like they have for generations.
Poliquin says the park needs to work with Mainers, not penalize them.
These folks came to us and said, you know, some of the folks at the Park Service were saying, you know, you got to turn over your bucket or get summoned. And this is after, you know, working a full tide, you know, maybe having $100 worth of worms, sand worms and blood worms, and having to, you know, turn that over and move on is just totally unacceptable.
Poliquin says the bill addresses waste disposal concerns on Mount Desert Island and makes permanent the Acadia National Park Advisory Commission, which ensures local input in park issues. Continued drought conditions are taking a toll on Poland Springs operations. Groundwater levels are dropping at a key aquifer in Hollis, home to the company's largest bottling plant, and at its springs in Poland. So the company is trucking in water from more distant sources in the Rangeley area and running a smaller bottling plant in Kingfield 24/7. Thomas Brennan is the company's senior natural resources manager. He says planning for the drought began last winter.
We could see it coming. We could see in over the winter that there wasn't a lot of snow. And we know from experience, when you don't have snowpack and you don't have spring rains like happened this year, you need to take steps to protect the business.
Brennan says groundwater levels and stream flows at company-operated resources have stayed within its permit requirements. Parts of Maine are experiencing the worst drought in 15 years. The federal government has declared extreme drought conditions in most of southern Maine and severe conditions in much of the rest of the state. A new rule is now in effect to try to protect Maine loons from lead poisoning. Prior to 2002, lead was responsible for nearly a third of all mortality in adult loons. So in 2013, Maine lawmakers passed an act to protect Maine loons by banning lead sinkers and jigs. Susan Gallo is with Maine Audubon, which is part of a coalition of groups trying to encourage the purchase and use of lead-free fishing tackle. She says one provision of the law didn't take effect until September of this year.
And part of that is a ban on the use of bare lead-headed jigs, 2.5 inches or less in length. We know that lead-headed jigs end up in loon gizzards and that they're deadly for loons. And the loons die within a matter of a couple of weeks of ingesting a lead-headed jig.
Gallo says it's much easier to find lead-free fishing tackle in stores now, and she says more and more anglers appear to be interested in making the switch on their own. For a list of retailers and more information about lead-free tackle regulations, visit fishleadfree.org. A new grassroots wildlife advocacy group is opposing a plan advanced by the State Department of Inland Fisheries and Wildlife to extend the season for hunting bobcats and trapping beavers. Karen Coker of Wild Watch Maine says the department wants to add a week in February to the bobcat season and an additional 2 weeks to the beaver trapping season to provide more opportunity for hunters and trappers. Coker says the department cited low fur prices as factors in its management plan and that those prices caused the animal populations to rise.
Our concern is that low fur prices and providing hunters and trappers more opportunity is not really a valid way to manage wildlife populations.
Coker says there's no definitive data on the state's bobcat and beaver populations.
In the case of bobcats, there is absolutely no data from the department that supports a season extension. In fact, the data suggests that bobcats could be in peril because the harvest numbers of bobcats last year were at a 10-year low.
She says wildlife advocates who are concerned about extending the seasons for both animals should contact the Department of Inland Fisheries and Wildlife in Augusta before Thursday. A mail carrier for Swan's Island in Frenchboro has been restored to his position after he lost the contract in a battle with the U.S. Postal Service about whether he could carry mail with freight items. L.J. Hopkins had provided the service for nearly three decades until the Postal Service told him last spring he couldn't carry mail with other deliveries. After a lawsuit was filed, the Postal Service amended the contract, but Hopkins' attorney Keith Hareton says the ultimate victory was when Hopkins was awarded the position last week.
LJ's service provides auto parts. It provides emergency medicines and all the groceries that are sold at the only market that services both Swans and Frenchboro.
Hareton says the Postal Service contract provides critical income that allows Hopkins to also make those freight deliveries. The owner of Swans Island's general store, Brian Kraftjack, says allowing combined mail and freight delivery is critical because the islands are too small to financially support a standalone service for either.
As the store owner, we depend heavily on a freight service to bring everything that's stocked in our store. For the island, it means people can continue to get their prescriptions, they can continue to get everything else they depended on LJ to bring.
Hopkins' new contract begins October 17th. As the sea ice in the Arctic continues to melt, large areas of water are opening up, and the prospect of an Arctic passage is drawing much interest from commercial shipping companies and from the governments and military forces of northern nations. A group called the Arctic Council, dedicated to shaping a peaceful future for the region, is holding a high-level meeting in Portland this week. On today's Maine Calling, Jennifer Rook spoke with Dr. Adriana Muir of the U.S. State Department, U.S. Senator Angus King of Maine, and Rafe Pomerantz, chairman of Arctic 21, a coalition of non-governmental organizations concerned with climate change in the region. Pomerantz describes what's become known as Arctic unraveling, which begins with the rapid decline in sea ice.
That's accompanied by loss of northern hemisphere snow cover, thawing of permafrost, shrinkage of the Greenland ice sheet, and shrinkage of all the other Arctic glacial systems. So across the board, the trends are part of the unraveling. And that unraveling has consequences in the Arctic and for the world and the lower 48, including Maine. Because models, for example, the models project there will be a lot more Gulf Stream, warm water flowing into the Gulf of Maine, and it will become one of the hot spots in the world, transforming the biology of the Gulf of Maine.
So much for haddock and lobster.
Well, the fisheries are moving northward, and big changes are already underway in the Gulf.
Adriana, you're here with the State Department. There was a really interesting 60 Minutes piece about the Arctic, and one of the things it stressed and one of the things we're learning as we learn about the Arctic is that no one is in charge. Even the Arctic Council here, the people who are gathering with these great minds, they don't have the power to make laws or enforce them. How does the State Department approach working with the other countries as we move forward in thinking about the Arctic?
The Arctic Council is a forum of the eight Arctic nations. It just turned 20 years old. And one of the main things we say we've accomplished during those 20 years is maintaining the Arctic as a region of peace and cooperation. And that, I think, is something to really take solace in. And while no individual country or one forum or international organization may be, quote unquote, in charge, I think you really do see a good air of cooperation. You really see an understanding by each of these countries that they need to rely on the other in order to somehow capture all of the scientific information to get at the changes that Mr. Pomerantz just described. You need each other to make sure that the rule of law really is going to be followed by other countries who want to take advantage of new shipping routes, et cetera. So what we've seen from the State Department is a great sense of international cooperation. We don't see the competition or the race for resources or the struggle for territory that is sometimes described in the media. Of course, everyone is keeping an eye out for that. Makes sense to do so. But really, on a day-to-day basis, we have an air of collegiality within the Arctic Council, and we're really hopeful that we will be able to do this in a good setting of international cooperation.
All right. But on last night's 60 Minutes piece, Senator King, the Leslie Stahl interviewed the general who had been in charge of the Arctic for NATO, and he said that the Russians do want to control the Northeast Passage and have claimed the Arctic as part of Russia.
Well, there's no question that they're being very aggressive. It's interesting because on the one hand, they're cooperating. On the other hand, they're building bases. They have vastly increased their icebreaker fleet. They have something like 17 up there. We have 1.5. The half is used for spare parts. It's hard to tell exactly what they're up to and whether it's aggressive or defensive, but they're definitely making significant investments along the Russian shoreline. On the other hand, on things like search and rescue, scientific research, sharing of data, they're cooperating and they're working together. They seem to be able to compartmentalize on these issues, and it's the one area of the world where we have had some success working with the Russians, and I think they see it as it's got to be a joint enterprise.
Speaking of a joint enterprise, Rafe, do you feel as though when you meet with your colleagues from other nations that there's an equivalence in the commitment to protecting the environment of the Arctic?
I would say we're now facing an unprecedented challenge. And it remains to be seen whether the nations that are most in charge of making what's required happen will step up. I think the Arctic has deteriorated so rapidly that the world hasn't really caught up with it. It is the example of rapid climate change. It is clearer than any place else with enormous consequences. And to me, the central issue is focusing on what is the Arctic future. There has to be a decision because it takes decades to actually achieve it. But if we don't, then it goes.
Jennifer, I think an interesting way to think about this, the Arctic Ocean has been frozen for all of human history. We have no experience with it as a body of water. It's as if we are suddenly discovering the Mediterranean Sea. And the question is whether we're going to be able to deal with all the issues that surround this body of water with countries bordering on all sides, different countries, in a peaceful, non-confrontational way. It took about 1,000 years of war to get things sorted out in the Mediterranean Sea, and we certainly want to avoid that. This is a world historic event that's going on that's like nothing else people have seen in human history. So how we manage to figure out whether we can do it peacefully and cooperatively, that's the key question.
You can hear more of that conversation anytime at mainpublic.org. And that's the news on This Day in Maine, Monday, October 3rd, 2016. Our theme music was composed by Robert Holt. Thanks to our news leaders Keith Chordall and Susan Sharon, and to Fred Bever, A.J. Higgins, Mal Leary, Steve Missler, and Patty White for their contributions. We'd like to hear your thoughts on the podcast. You can rate and comment in iTunes or email us at tdim@mainpublic.org. I'm Andrew Catalina. For all of us here at mainpublic.org, thanks for listening.